Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Racism has been part of our country's story since its founding. Over the last 247 years, we've made progress toward dismantling racism, and we've had setbacks. Tragically, many of the setbacks involve the loss of life. Most racial justice experts believe that progress must involve white people confronting the reality of white privilege and systemic racism, and taking action to dismantle these systems and mindsets. Debbie Irving is a white woman who had this epiphany over a decade ago. She wrote a white racial identity memoir titled Waking Up White, Finding Myself in the Story of Race. The book became a bestseller and initiated conversations about race in white communities across the country. Now, a decade after the publication of Waking Up White, Debbie Irving joins us to discuss what's changed in our country and, more importantly, what is the way forward to racial equity. Debbie Irving, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Mindy. Thanks so much for having me on.
So before the book came out, most white people weren't seeing themselves in conversations about race and racism. The terms white privilege, even systemic racism, were new to many people. So to understand how you came to the place to write the book, tell us about yourself and your background. You know, you grew up in Massachusetts, right?
Right. I grew up in a suburb just north of Boston, Winchester. An affluent suburb. I think that's an important because there's a class element of this too. And I lived there my whole life until I was 18 years old. And I had, you know, extensive family throughout New England, and we all lived in similar homes and similar neighborhoods. So I had sort of a Norman Rockwell-esque childhood. People can usually picture that. That's what my life looked like. So I didn't understand at the time that I was having an incredibly homogeneous childhood in which whiteness, meaning white people and all of our attitudes and behaviors, were all being normalized for me. And even beyond my immediate experience, the television shows, I was born in 1960. So era matters when we think about our racial identity too. In the 60s and 70s, the television shows I was getting looked just like my family too. So I have this incredibly narrow worldview without knowing I have a narrow worldview.
Right.
Cut to, I go to a white bubble college experience, Kenyon College in Ohio. I come back. I start working at the intersection of arts and education in Boston and Cambridge. And suddenly I'm in neighborhoods that look like nothing I've ever seen, not even on television. And these are black neighborhoods, which we called, quote unquote, inner city neighborhoods or under-resourced neighborhoods or underprivileged neighborhoods, and where buildings were dilapidated. And schools were really overcrowded because I was, you know, part of my job was around education. I was in schools and I used my narrow worldview to interpret what I was seeing. That's what we all do every day.
Right.
And I've been taught that the playing field is level. This is the place of the land of opportunity. We've even got the bootstraps when we're pursuing the American dream. So I saw the whole world as individual effort or lack of effort. And my assumption, my very incorrect and racist assumption, when I looked at the these neighborhoods and the people in them, was that, quote unquote, if you could see my fingers, they hadn't worked hard enough, or maybe they just didn't know enough about the world to get ahead. And at age 22, I thought I had the answers for them. And I swung into overdrive, joining diversity committees, raising money for after-school programs. And it would take me 25 years to understand that I was in a really damaging mindset, what we now call the white savior syndrome. Yeah. My help wasn't needed or wanted, and I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah. And you had what we might call an aha moment after many years of having a feeling that something wasn't quite right in a graduate class you were taking. Tell us about the epiphany.
Yeah, it was, so it wasn't, it was a five, it was 4 or 5 months of learning history I had never learned and broadening that worldview. And by the way, I was a history major in college. So to say I learned history I hadn't learned that shocked me is worth pausing on. There was one moment that really stands out as the pivotal moment. And that was the night we were watching a film called Race, The Power of an Illusion. It's a WGBH. It was aired by WGBH, not produced by GBH. It's like 30 years old at this point. But I hear this one line that will change my life. The 1.2 million Black GIs that also fought in World War II were mostly unable to access the GI Bill. Well, I was 48 years old at that time. I knew my father and all my uncles and all the men around me had used that GI Bill to buy homes. My parents bought that home in Winchester with it. My dad went to Harvard Law School on it. So I thought I knew all about the GI Bill, but to entertain the idea that, well, the first thing I had to take in was there were 1.2 million Black GIs in World War II. Where were they in my textbooks, my history books, in my family stories, my television shows? How do I get 48 not know that? And then to start to break apart, well, why weren't they able to access the housing or education components of the GI Bill? And that's a long, complicated story, but it does start to reveal how systemic racism works. And I can explain that if you want, but it didn't say anywhere in the GI Bill that it was a white-only bill. It's that we had barriers throughout society that were already making it difficult to impossible for Black and Brown people to access education, housing, as well as some of the other components of the GI Bill.
This moment started you on this journey, as you say, waking up to your whiteness and your internalized racism. It wasn't easy, right? So share some of those more difficult experiences. First, you're coming to this realization, but then it's like, wow, what do I do with this?
I think the hardest part, and this is what I did not learn in the course. So the course ends, and I had t taken the course because I was going to get my master's in special education. I was a public school teacher at the time. And I felt at the end of that course, like, who let me loose, especially in front of kindergartens? Like, kindergartners, I need to go continue my education. So Waking Up White chronicles the continuation of that education. What that initial course did not prepare me for, and therefore, this was the biggest shockwave to my system, was that all the cultural tools I had learned to interact with people, to interact with a complicated issue, all of those attitudes and behaviors backfired in anti-racism. I was taught not to rock the boat. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And suddenly I find myself in really intense conversations. And so I recognized I did not have the emotional resilience. And that was one of the first big things I had to change about myself, was I had to learn how to become a much more emotionally courageous, and resilient person.
You write that talking about race and specifically whiteness is almost taboo, so much so that you didn't even see yourself having a race. That was something other people had, Black and brown people. So tell us more about that.
Well, I grew up in this era where we were taught to be colorblind. We don't see color, as if that's possible. Well, if you don't see it, you're certainly not going to be talking about it. And so I did think that race was, and racism was, something that belonged to other people. That's the white savior thing. But I'm going to come in and help those people with their problem over there. And what I didn't recognize, that there is no such thing as being raceless in a society that is completely constructed around race as a tool, around class. That all gets complicated, but that is a true statement that I just said. And it's this mindset that allows people who live in predominantly white spaces to say, like suburbs, for instance, if they're still white, is, we don't have racism here. We're all white. That's a very common statement I still hear people say. And I mean, just to clarify, I did know to check off white if I'm looking, it was looking at a form. I just didn't understand the implications.
And you talked about working, moving into this inner city and working with disadvantaged, so-called disadvantaged children. Your intentions were good, right? But so as you're realizing all of this, you're going about it the wrong way. Where do you go with that? How do you, you're looking at this from a different viewpoint now, right? So it's all of the training, all of the things you grew up with, is you realize it's all wrong.
Well, that's why I didn't go back into the school system. That's why I said, like, I can't, I feel like a dangerous person almost now as a white woman in the Cambridge public schools, where often I'd be in classrooms where 50% of the kids and the families were people of color. And also because I hadn't been ignoring the topic, I had been skating around it, thinking I was dealing with it, being on all of these diversity committees, raising this money for quote unquote inner city children. And so I had 25 years of memories where I could now say, oh my God, that's what that tension. I knew there was an elephant in the room. I just didn't know it was me. Like, I had a lot of reprocessing to do. Suddenly, a lot of tensions made sense, a lot of awkward moments, a lot of lost friendships made sense. And that was super cringy and
Yeah.
full of shame. And I just had to work through that.
Yeah. Our society is packed with clues and messages about who is best, prettiest, most likely to succeed in our society. And these messages, as you're sort of talking about, have this profound impact on our worldview. So talk about the racist messaging that's been part of our society for generations. People don't even know what's happening.
No, and I think, when I do keynotes and workshops, I'll often use a slide from the television show Father Knows Best, which was a very popular show in my
I
childhood.
remember it.
And you remember it. And for people who don't know the show and can't picture it, it's the advertisement for the show sort of says it all. Think of the words Father Knows Best at the top of this image. And then there's a, everyone's white, of course. It's a family with a mom and a dad and a son and two daughters. And they're all, the dad's in the center and he's holding a telephone. Everyone is super happy. And, we will spend 20 minutes unpacking the messaging of that slide. So what that slide is projecting onto us is, this is what all American looks like, guys. These are the, this is the best kind of American family to be. Dad is at the center and he knows best. And there's a value system, because anytime someone knows best, well, the people around her, kids don't know best, mom doesn't know best, so dad's got the power in the family. And there, it's normalizing whiteness. All, and by the way, it wasn't just this show. There were, this is what the shows were of this era that I was exposed to. These are all church-going Christians. Everybody presents as heterosexual. Everyone is cisgender. We don't even have the language for that at the time, but we're getting that idea. They're very, all American has a very middle class message in it. We don't see working class or impoverished families. It's always middle class. And I have had people come up to me at the end of talks who are white, who will say, they'll wait for everybody else to leave. And then they'll find me alone and they'll say, I'm so glad you said that thing about class and the all-American messaging, because I grew up impoverished or I grew up working class. Those shows gutted me. They made me think my parents were failures. Why didn't we have that kind of stuff? Why didn't we have those kind of clothes?
Yeah, I was thinking that
So
as you were describing it, going, and if your family doesn't match this, you say, what's wrong with me or what's wrong with us, right? That we're not this family. Yeah. All right.
And they were all, they were of a certain size and shape. Like even that perfect body, there was a definition of what stands for the right size.
Yeah.
All their teeth were perfect. It was just, it was a nearly impossible
Say
image.
not
And we all,
reality, right?
and yet so many of us, including my family, were striving hard to look like that and then self-blaming if we didn't.
Right. We're talking about white privilege and racism with Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White. How has your understanding of systemic racism and white privilege changed over the past decade? You can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about white privilege and racism with Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White. How has your understanding of systemic racism and white privilege changed over the past decade? We'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626 or our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before the break, we're talking about, Father Knows Best and the impact on our white families. But imagine being a family of color, right? I mean, and there were, I think maybe was it Julia, the one, there was like one TV show maybe that had a black person in it, right? They weren't represented at all.
Well, and if they were represented, it was in a role of servitude,
Right.
or perhaps somebody to poke fun at. It was never the person who warranted our respect or had any wisdom to contribute to whatever the sort of message of the show was. And yes, we were all stuck with the same set of television shows. And I have so many friends and colleagues of color who talk about what that did to their self-image.
And you mentioned the systemic racism and some examples of that. We talked about GI Bill, home mortgage lending practices, schools. Talk a little bit about some of the systemic racism that what it was and we're still seeing today in some areas.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the most really important way to understand racism, it begins with an ideology, and the ideology around racism is completely connected to ideas around class and gender and religion and ethnicity and ability and all of that. And the idea is that we're not all of equal value. Some people are more important than others. And the most important kind of human being, sort of on top of the human being pile, is a well-to-do, once upon a time we would have called this a land-owning white male who's Christian. And again, all that heterosexual ability, able-bodied, all that is baked in there. And our policies and practices in the country favor that group. And that it makes sense. Those were the original people who came, and they built systems by, those systems are by and for them. And so ever since our earliest days, we have been, and if you're not that category, we are in a struggle for increasing rights for women, for people who identify as queer, for working class, and for people who are impoverished, for people who aren't Christian. I mean, look at what's going on now with Islamophobia, for instance. So, and anti-Semitism. So, when we look at racism, we're looking at one strand of that sort of complex, I call it a labyrinth of hierarchies. And so how does it play out? Well, let's go back to what I didn't talk about with the GI Bill. I think redlining is one of the best examples there is. So and though it's old, it's 80 years old, it's this kind of stuff still happens today, but it's a great example. So in the 1930s, Franklin Delano Roosevelt becomes president. He inherits the fallout of the Great Depression, creates this back to work economic stimulus program called the New Deal. As a part of that, there's all this new residential housing stock built, and the government comes up with two new agencies to help figure out how to fund that, because you've got people coming out of a depression and you've got all this new housing stock. Well, how are people who are in a financially depressed state going to afford this? So to bridge that gap, that's the moment the mortgage gets invented. The mortgage is not an equal playing field. What happens in this moment is the FHA government creates two new agencies to manage this new mortgage thing, FHA Home and Loan Corporation. They come up with a set of recommendations for when the government makes loan and when private banks make loans. And it comes down to two basic criteria. One is if the consider the condition of the building. Recommendation, don't make a loan into a building that's deteriorating. That makes perfect sense to me. Condition number two is the skin color of the residents living in the neighborhood around that building. And the exact language was the presence of even one or two non-white families can undermine real estate values. So based on that recommendation, cities all over the country, they roll out maps of their cities, and they engage in this practice called redlining, in which there are four, it's a color-coded system, there are four colors. And the red-lined areas are where Black folks and Jewish folks at the time lived. This is a moment where Jewish folks get to be considered white and get out of those neighborhoods. And that is considered hazardous. If you look at the keys on these maps, the legends, it will say red equals hazardous. That means a hazardous lending opportunity. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we have green line neighborhoods, and that's not just white families, but white families that look like that father knows best. There's a class, white families who are already middle class, and that's where the GI Bill was good. So for Black and brown people, they couldn't get into the neighborhood where the GI Bill was being offered. So that's the barrier I'm talking about. That's systemic racism. It's another way to think about it is it's bias or prejudice can happen between two people or groups of people. But systemic racism is when a group or a person has the power to embed their positive or negative bias into a system where it impacts hundreds, thousands, millions of people. And that is what redlining did.
Since your book came out, what are some of the changes you're seeing in white people's conversations around racism and whiteness?
It is amazing. When my book first came out, most of the white people in my life were saying, yay, President Barack Obama was in office, we're post-racial. That's not what other people who really understood racism were saying. They were saying, watch out. We are headed for something really ugly. There's going to be a backlash. And now nobody, of course, says we're post-racial. That would be something no one would say. And so I've watched a couple things happen. I have watched conversations amongst my white family and friends become incredibly sophisticated. A lot of people have put themselves on an intense learning journey and gotten into groups, white groups, cross-racial groups. There's this incredible awakening that is happening. And alongside that is this incredible resistance movement of people who think talking about this is we're inventing something, we're talking about something that doesn't exist, talking about it is racist, talking about it makes it worse. And so this polarization is just extreme. And everybody listening, I think, can relate to that. Often in our own friend and family circles, we've watched these fractures to the point where we can barely talk to each other. And of course, the media machine it perpetuates this. We have so many channels, meaning internet channels too. There's just so many places to get our information that we are very possibly getting completely different information from our neighbors. And so I think actually one of the growing edges of the work is to change the way we have conversations. And the kind of conversations I'm interested in are what I would call transformational conversations, where nobody's attacking. We're really trying to listen and learn from each other.
I think you bring up a really good point about you wanting to listen and learn, and there are a lot of white people who are trying to do that. And I think sometimes the conversations, I mean, it's difficult, right? And you're going to make mistakes, and you're going to say things that are wrong, and it's all a learning process. But it strikes me that, you know, I was born a few years before you, and so I remember the civil rights movement in the 1960s, as do, you know, many people in our age range. And I remember after George Floyd, we saw these protests and all these people, you know, white people saying, you know, we've got to, you know, do something. A lot of the people of color I know were like, oh, I'm going, this is great. I'm so optimistic. And they're like, yeah, well, we'll see. Yeah, you know, we'll see. Because been there, right? We've been
Been there,
there.
done
And
that.
it's like, in a lot of ways, I feel like we're back in the 1960s. It's like, who would have thought we've, you know, make these couple steps forward, and now, you know, as all of this comes to light and we learn more. I told you before we went on the air, I thought I understood this battle, you know, you know, from my experience in the 1960s. I did not. You know, it's only been recently, like you, that you go, whoa, I did not know that. I didn't. I don't think I really understood what whiteness meant.
Yeah, and I think the battle itself has changed.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The landscape is always changing around us. And that's one of the big problems is the culture of whiteness is very much a status quo culture. It wants to hold everything in place. And so we don't culturally really have tools that help us adapt with change. I think, you know, there's a lot that's different. And yet we're going through a cycle that we've gone through before. There's a wonderful scholar, Dr. Carol Anderson, who's written a book called White Rage. She wrote it a couple years ago that just beautifully describes the other moments in history where there's been specifically Black achievement and then white lash. And you know, she would say that we are in that moment. I think one of the things that is very different now than was different right after the Civil Rights Movement, even though I wasn't old enough to know, so I'm telling you what I've learned, not what I've lived through, is that Black and Brown people, many of them after George Floyd's murder, because remember that was during a pandemic, that wasn't the only we had had. Ahmaud Arbery had been brutally, practically lynched on camera, you know, by being shot while jogging, and then Breonna Taylor shot in her own apartment. So it was a triple hit. And during a pandemic, and that just broke something. And I think broke in a good way. And a lot of Black and Brown people, their response, the white people, like, whoa, what? Really? I'm going to stand up and fight now. A lot of Black and Brown people were like, I've had enough. I'm going to be unapologetic about what I feel. I'm going to stop trying to play nice. I'm just going to be honest. And that has stayed. I think there's been an incredible consciousness raising for all of us because of the unguardedness that was a result of that. And a lot of people lost their jobs, but felt like I don't want to come to work every day. It's toxic to me. I'm going to tell you how I feel about this workplace. And so I've seen a ton of growth in organizations because of that truth telling by Black and Brown people. And in my opinion, as a white person, we should all be so incredibly grateful for any truth telling. If we're lucky, we get told what the impact is we and the system we created or our forebears created has on the world.
We talk about organizations. In the past 5 to 10 years, we've seen many organizations and companies take up diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives. But are we seeing people of color represented in staff, boards, leadership positions, positions that have power to make change?
The higher you go up the hierarchy in any organization, the more male, the more white, the more educated, formally educated. We're all educated. There's no such thing as not being educated. We're all living, we're having experiences, we're learning, but formal education where you have degrees. And so that pattern continues. And so we talk a lot in organizational work about pipelines. Do we have pipelines? Do we have mentoring systems? And there has to be, this is why leadership can't outsource DEI work as some kind of a department. It would be like outsourcing technology to a department. Yeah, you have your people who lead the work, but technology is integrated throughout the organization. And DEI work has to be integrated throughout the organization, and you need buy-in at the top.
So are we seeing shifts in media to better reflect the race and ethnicity of all Americans? What do you think is happening? Are there any kind of notable examples, or where are we falling short?
Well, the best people, of course, to answer any question about how we're doing, if we're talking about ability, the best people to answer it are people with disabilities. And when we're talking about racism, the best people to answer how we're doing is not a white person. It's really people of color. But let me give you my best assessment. I will say, as a media consumer, I feel like I have a lot more choices. I mean, just recently, there's the Bob Marley movie, there's Origins, which I've seen. There's American Fiction. So on the movie scene, I feel like there's an opening up, but it's still so relative. I don't think Black or Brown actresses or screenwriters would say, "Woo, we've really hit our stride." I think it's still very much of a work in progress. And in terms of what we can consume and with the news, I mean, this goes right back to people pick what keeps them comfortable. So what I say, if there are white listeners here, if you start noticing that you're listening to white voices day in and day out, it takes intention in this complex web of information, intention to go find sources, follow people on social media, find some news channels that bring a different perspective. I think NPR, WGBH are, outstanding in and have been for a long time at giving us multiple perspectives and not choosing a very narrow perspective and sticking to it. So, not a very focused answer, some
No,
rambling there,
it's
but
helpful. Yeah.
that's
Yeah.
my stream of consciousness answer.
So in the past decades, what shifts have you seen in how nonprofits, educators, and others approaching programs that serve people of color? Are there some, important changes that we're seeing happening?
Oh, I think the most important change I've seen in the nonprofit world is, funders, and I was a fundraiser in my nonprofit world. We had to report very frequently. You have to write, the old way is to have to write these incredibly long applications and give years' worth of budget information and I always felt like I had to have my grammar just right. Everything had to be perfect. It's really different now. There are people who are able to access funding, people from marginalized organizations who are able to access funding without jumping through hoops. And then there also was a sort of heavy monitoring coming because these are white institutions giving white wealth to Black and Brown communities often. And there was this sense like, well, you better meet your mark in a year or we won't give you another year of funding. Well, we're talking about a 400-year-old problem. And so now we're looking at timelines that are much more like 10 years long instead of monitoring for 1 year, and much more how can we continue to give you support as opposed to how can we? And the we here Interesting choice, the perspective that I'm choosing. But we, the we I'm referring to is the money giving institution. Continue to tell us, let's continue to build our relationship. I can't say that all nonprofits and funders are having this relationship, but that is the growing edge of the work. There's a guy named Edward Villanueva who wrote a book, and I'm forgetting the name of it, but it's about that cutting edge of funding. And he was a man, is a man of color who had found himself in the philanthropic world and started to notice we're kind of reproducing the whole problem through our grant making system.
We are talking about white privilege and racism with Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White. We'd love to hear from you. How has your understanding of systemic racism and white privilege changed over the past decade? Or if you'd just like to join the conversation, you have a question, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about white privilege and racism with Debbie Irving, author of Waking Up White. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. As we see an increased awareness of white privilege and systemic racism in some communities, states like Texas and Florida have passed laws about what can and cannot be taught in schools around race. Talk a little bit about that juxtaposition.
And before I do, I just want to give a proper shout out because I didn't get the name and book title
Oh,
right.
yeah, go ahead.
If you're in the philanthropy sector or thinking or in a nonprofit sector, the book is by Edgar Villanueva, Decolonizing Wealth. Indigenous wisdom to heal divides and restore balance. Super readable, really good book. Okay, so the movement, the backlash movement to shut down teaching specifically about, well, it includes shutting down education around racism, ability, ableism. You know, there are books that are being banned that are about kids with Down syndrome. Shutting down the conversation around any kind of sexual or gender difference. So this is recalibrating us to the Father Knows Best era, where the right way to be is, you know, white, heterosexual, and without any disabilities. And this is so dangerous. I think there's a fear. You know, I spend a lot of time, I lead these transformational conversation workshops in which we learn to speak to each other differently. And I use scenarios. And the scenario I use is someone says, I'm so glad there are book bans. Who wants their kids learning that stuff? And we spend time trying to imagine, you know, what is going on for this person? Why would somebody want book bans? And I think because it's never okay to dehumanize and just dismiss another person's perspective. We have to understand one another. And I think it is scary for people to who hold that position of we shouldn't be teaching this is dangerous, scary stuff. They think that you're going to create racism by talking about it. They think you're going to create gayness by talking about it. I don't know what they think about ableism, but when you don't have books that represent the full spectrum of human experience, which does include race and a multitude of gender and sexuality expressions, I mean, that is a part of nature. It is only in very modern history that we've tried to tell people you are strictly, you know, this or that. When you remove that representation, you not only tell people who fit that identity, we don't care about you, you don't exist, just fit in as best you can and don't complain. You're also removing the ability to educate everybody else about who our others are. Everyone knows who white people are. We're all over the place. We're represented everywhere. It's time to diversify how we understand our world because our world by nature is diverse.
So what can communities in those states and elsewhere do in response? You know, if you're in those communities and you don't agree with this, what do you do?
Oh, there is so much. The thing is, you can't shut down this work. People like me who are passionate about this work. We're not going to stop being passionate because of laws. So in these states where it's happening, it's very difficult. And yet in every state, you can join surge showing up for racial justice. In every state you can and city you can Google anti-racism, fill in your city. You will find people who are doing this work. Social justice, fill in your town. You will find people who are doing this work. Join with them, learn with them. This is about creating a world that, as Adrienne Marie Brown says, we're trying to create a world that does not yet exist. So we're not trying to go back to something that looked clean and shiny but excluded most people. We're trying to create a world that really is that life, liberty, justice for all, that promise that I grew up with, that we do all belong, and that we can all achieve our dreams. That's what we're fighting for. And so these spaces, a lot of times I think people think I'm going to walk in, I'm going to be yelled at, I don't get the pronouns right, I don't get this word right. If you're seeing it done that way, that's not the that's outdated. The movements that I'm a part of are very joyful. We tell lots of stories, and really get to know one another so that we can co-create together.
Yeah, I think you just said something really important, which is get to know one another. I think sometimes that fear just comes out of obviously not understanding and the other, right? That's the other. And when you don't understand the other, you can dehumanize and you can, get that in your head. But when you have these conversations that are not confrontational, we have these conversations and you're learning about the other, it opens up a whole new dialogue, right? I mean, that then you understand why we don't want to ban these books and, what it would be to be inclusive. So how do, when you have these conversations, how do you keep them, I guess civil and in a space that's not judging other people or, turning into these shouting matches? How do you move forward?
Well, every tool, every teaching tool I've ever created is a tool I create first for myself, because like I'm not out of any of this mess. I'm working on it. I have a practice to find other ways. So for instance, I was taught in a conversation to either avoid conflict. That's what my household taught me. And there were other places that taught me, or win. Like look good, look smart, don't let them see you sweat, don't back down. And so I've actually come up with eight ways that I was taught to engage in conversation that totally backfire. They're not good for relationships, and that includes the relationship I have with my daughters or my husband. So the beautiful thing about this work and the conversational piece of it that I'm doing is it's just expanding my ability to connect with everybody more deeply, including myself. So here are some of the norms I use in these healthier, what I call transformational conversations. I make sure I slow down. It's a huge one. I expect to explore, let the conversation unfold organically. I'm not fixed on convincing somebody of anything. I bring a lot of humility. I wonder what's my role in this conflict. Am I talking too much? Am I being too pushy? Was I too pushy? Did I alienate this person? What can I learn from you? Everyone has something to teach. I ask sincerely curious questions, and then I listen. I try to connect. I try to find where we overlap. We all overlap. We all have something in common. When we have those kind of conversations, there is no outcome that we can predict. There are infinite possibilities about where that conversation can go or where that relationship can go. We need to stop cutting people out of our lives. And yet we also do need to set healthy boundaries when people are abusive.
Since 2016, we've talked a lot about the increasing polarization of our country. When political candidates make remarks that many view as racist, it's hard not to see those who support that candidate as racist too. So, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think too many white people are willing to overlook the racism because there's a this, that, or the other policy that they believe in. And I think it's too bad we're in a two-party system. I wish we had more candidates. I think that's what I think about that. And I wish for everybody that our top priority was to understand the racist history that none of us invented. We all inherited it. And once we understand it, we can start to outgrow it. But we can't possibly do that until we understand it. And it's horrifying to me to see politicians who don't either don't understand it or do understand it and are using it to manipulate us.
Yeah. You mentioned about being a history major, and I'm just thinking, as a history major, you just must have been horrified as you learn, the real history. And I'm not just talking about I'm talking, Native American history as well, and all the things that we were taught that either aren't true or we didn't get so many stories that actually happened. You look at Black history. I mean, the many people who've done amazing things that we've never even heard of. So, how do we correct that? How do we,
Well, we don't ban books.
yeah, well, that's a start. Yeah, but I mean, but even in areas where we're not banning books, this history, a lot of it isn't told.
This history is, I mean, if for people who read my book, Waking Up White, my opening story is I'm 5 years old. I'm in the car with my mother, and I asked her whatever happened to all the Indians. And her answer to me, this is a beautiful, soft-hearted woman. She tells me what she was taught when she was somewhere in her life. They're extinct. They drank themselves to death. So not only did I not, I'm climbing Mount Monadnock. I'm living in Massachusetts, which, by the way, is an Algonquin word that means at the large hill. I'm swimming in Lake Winnipesaukee. I mean, I've got signs of indigeneity all around me, but I'm making the connection because I was taught to erase. And so not erasing, we have a huge course correction. I see this work as a massive course correction. And yes, I am a racial justice educator. I specifically think that education is a really powerful tool in that course correction. And there's no reason anybody can't go out and start educating themselves.
And now we have, I mean, there's so many more books, and the, there's so much out there resources now that we can find this information. So how do you define being an anti-racist?
Anti-racism means I am against racism. I am not for it. And there's really, and this was a hard concept for me, and it's a hard concept for a lot of people. Howard Zinn said, you can't be neutral on a moving train. And we are on a moving train. So just sort of thinking that racism isn't my cause, it's everybody's cause. So to be anti-racist means to be against it. And I thought I really appreciate Ibram Kendi's work because he complicates that in a good way, complicates it by saying, look at any one of us can have a racist thought one moment and an anti-racist thought the next. And this is getting away from that binary thinking that is very embedded in the Anglo culture, which is the white culture of whiteness. It's so much more fluid and complicated. So I can tell you that I'm an anti-racist, and yet I catch myself having racist thoughts. I catch myself in racist born behaviors. So I'm an aspiring anti-racist, I would say. And it's a practice. I practice it every day.
You're noticing it. That's the key, right? And changing
Yes,
behavior, you've
noticing.
got to notice it to be able to change it. So what are some of the most significant things that you've learned over the past 10 years from the publication and the subsequent outcomes from the book?
Well, I think, this emotional growth that I had to do to be able to be in these hard conversations is huge. Oh boy, I had about a year after the book came out, I was at a book table. I had given a keynote. I'm in the audit. Now I'm outside in the lobby with a local bookseller. I've never met her before. She shows up with, I don't know how many of my books. We're sitting at the table. There's a long line. People are coming through. She sells. I sign and chat. And about 30 minutes in, she leans over. She said, Debbie, you just stood for the first time in 30 minutes. You hadn't stood for anybody else. And I looked away, and who's walking away from me but a guy, a white guy who looks like he just stepped out of a boardroom. And so, without even realizing it, I had stood up, shaken his hand, sat back down. If she had told me the next day, I don't think I would have believed her. But this was a moment for me where I thought, holy cow, this bias thing that I'm giving keynotes about bias, about negative bias, and I thought my big breakthrough was to help people understand there's positive bias too. Like I have positive bias towards white men, but the idea that it was living in my body and could mobilize me without my awareness, that was I felt like I was back at the bottom of, or at least looking at a new peak of the mountain I was
Yeah.
climbing. And it
Wow.
took me about a year and a half to completely overcome standing for a white man, because I would do it. I'd be in mid-handshake and I'd say, "Oh my God, you're doing it again." And then when I was able to see a white guy coming and say, don't stand. Just like, you either have to sit for everyone or stand for everybody. You're sitting, so stay seated." Like my body would nearly be trembling.
Wow. Yeah.
So that was a big learning.
Now, if you could rewrite waking up white, what would be different? Anything?
I wouldn't change a thing. It continues to be the 101 for white people. I'm working on another book, sort of, that picks up where Waking Up White left off, including I tell the standing for white men story. But that book is just, it's been so effective as a tool for communities to have conversations, for individuals to read and underline and dog ear. And people bring me these books to sign, and they just are so worked over. It's really a great tool. That's what it is. It's a
Yeah.
tool.
In so many conversations, we like you were mentioning earlier, we would need to ask somebody of color what they think about representation in TV is now. But I wonder if you could just talk for a moment about the importance of having white conversations. Here we are, two white women talking about this. Yes, it's important to have those voices in conversations, but it's also really important for white people to be talking about this.
It's huge. I think, it's important to put that in the larger context, which is the ultimate goal is multiracial coalition, multiracial, multiclass, multigenerational, co-creating of a world that's much closer to that life, liberty, justice for all. Yet within that large aspiration, each one of the identity groups, it's really helpful to meet together. So, white people meeting, Black people specifically, meeting together to help unlearn some of what they were taught. It's what it is. We're all unlearning. And so when you and I are going to have a very different conversation, because what we're unlearning is very different
Right.
than what a group of queer people, or even queer white people, or queer, you can just break it down into all of these specific identity groups. And
Yeah.
that's the value. We call the term for that is affinity groups, and they're incredibly valuable because we are going to be more honest probably when it's just us in the room, and the nature of our conversation, we will reflect for one another. You might say something, and I'll say, "Oh my God, Mindy, me too. I've never thought about it that way."
Yeah.
So that's the value of those conversations
Right.
and that work.
Marianne writes, thank you for this conversation. I'm remembering a conversation where my graduate school roommates got very angry when I brought up the idea of class in America. Reading Hillbilly Elegy, I realized when we advocate for Black communities, others may feel left behind. Some of our leaders eagerly capitalize on anger and gladly pit one disadvantage against the other. So in the end, the white power wealth class ends up on top. Marianne, thanks for sharing your thoughts with us.
Bingo.
Yeah. So, Debbie, I'm anxious to hear about this new book. I'll be looking for that. You make sure we get a copy when that comes out. Debbie Irving is author of Waking Up White. We'll post a link with more information about the book and her work as a racial justice educator at our website, capeandislands.org. Debbie, thanks for being with us. Always wonderful to have a conversation with you. Really appreciate it.
Same here, Mindy. I love being on the show with you. Thanks.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.